Case 13-23-134-CV, Adrian Peña Garza versus Cadence Bond.
May it please the court. Counsel. First of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to be in front of this court and before your honors again. The last time was before COVID, and it's great to be back.
We're glad to be back, too.
And so my name is Jason Davis, and I represent Adrian Peña Garza, who is the Republican chairwoman for the Hidalgo County Republican Party. And I say that because I noticed driving to the courthouse today, it's election day. And that's probably appropriate given the issues in this case. Because about a year ago, in October of last year, a week before voting started in the 2022 elections, the plaintiff in this case filed this suit against my client, the chairwoman of the Republican Party, and her brother, Aaron Peña. And your honors, if you have not read the original petition in this case, I implore you to please read that before rendering whatever decision you make. It's a remarkable document and one that can only be fairly characterized as a scurrilous attempt to smear Ms. Peña Garza's reputation, her family's reputation, and the Hidalgo County Republican Party. And the record before you shows that the claims in that original petition are so outlandish and outrageous that the plaintiff herself refused to verify them. And we'll get to that. There were objections to a verification, but it wasn't the plaintiff's. Instead of submitting her own sworn verification, it was of a third party, which will become important when we get to step two of the TCPA analysis. The only movement in this case, the appellant, is Adrian Peña Garza. The allegations in the original petition against Ms. Peña Garza are, quote, that she unilaterally appointed defendant Aaron Peña to the Hidalgo County Vacancy Committee. The allegations continue that this appointment, a political appointment, somehow gave him a right to deny applications of potential candidates. Quote, this appointment of defendant Aaron somehow aided and abetted him in an unwanted kissing event that forms the basis of the assault claim against him. So there is no question that as to Adrian Peña Garza, the factual basis for this suit is a political appointment by a chairperson of a political party. And that falls squarely within the TCPA's protection. Now, when you look at the original petition, you'll see the words Republican, GOP party, and appointment littered throughout. So we don't have to guess about the political motivation for this suit. Before we get into the TCPA, the consequences of allowing a civil claim for a political appointment would open up floodgates. Forget about Republican, Democrat, Independent. If all of a sudden the act of a political appointment can be aiding and abetting somehow a tort, not with an employee-employer relationship, that's not even alleged because there isn't one, no other legal duty, but the idea of a political appointment, whether it's by the county judge, whether it's a judge making an appointment of a special master, or the Republican chair or the Democratic chair, allowing such a claim to proceed will open up the floodgates, not only in this court, but throughout the courts of Texas.
And so let's take a step backwards in looking exactly at the first step. And what I'd like you to address first is why, setting aside everything, I just wanted to look at the statute. And I did have the original petition, and I have the book in front of me, the statute in front of me, is why this does not fall under the exception of 27.01, exception of a bodily injury. I don't think that looking at what the TCPA was originally to address for, they specifically led out in that section recovery for bodily injury, wrongful death, or survival, or to statements made regarding those legal actions. So why is this, which is, in looking at the petition, a tort, a bodily injury tort, assault, Why is this not fall under that statute exception?
It's an excellent question. There's two answers to that. One is that that wasn't pled by the plaintiff, and it wasn't included in the response until after the deadline. So the original petition does not include a claim for bodily injury.
Why don't you think it includes an injury for bodily injury? I mean, definitely aiding or abetting, as you just said, was addressed in the original petition. We're not talking about the amended petition. I'm just looking at the original petition. And definitely asked for damages arising out of that aiding and abetting.
It actually only asked for mental anguish. And we cited cases saying that there's obviously a difference between the two. And so that's why when we appeared for a hearing before the district court, and there was no proof and there was no allegation of bodily injury, that counsel for the plaintiff said, please allow us to give an affidavit. And the court rescheduled the hearing. Instead of just giving an affidavit, they repleted to include a bodily injury claim for the first time.
So are you telling me, as you read the statute, that the bodily injury as defined in this statute means an actual bodily injury damage as opposed to a bodily injury action? Because to me, there's a difference, right? You have a bodily injury, and then you can have the damages that arise out of that. And then you have bodily injury damages, physical damages, which the Texas Supreme Court has talked about having physical damage and mental anguish damage. But you can have a bodily injury damage that only encompasses mental anguish.
I'll say it two ways. One, it wasn't included, and therefore it shouldn't have been considered. But let's just assume that it was. Assume that the trial court properly considered the amended pleading. We don't think it did.
No, I don't think we need to go there, Mr. Davis. I think that what we're looking at is a pleading that alleges mental anguish only. Let's just talk about it's mental anguish only. Why is it not still considered a bodily injury?
Because the cases that we cited actually in our response brief actually make a distinction between the two. But I want to assume that they did.
Okay.
Because if I was standing here on behalf of Aaron Pena, who actually is being sued for assault, then I wouldn't be making this argument. And I would agree that if the plaintiff met their burden, Justice Longoria in the CDM case recognized that to prove an exemption is by preponderance of evidence on the party seeking the exemption. Okay?
Correct.
And in that case, it was a commercial exemption. In this case, it's the bodily injury. Okay? So assuming that they can satisfy that burden of bodily injury, let's just say if Aaron Pena was here, that would be the end of the story. But he's not. Because Adrian Pena is not being sued for assault. She's being sued for aiding and abetting, which has different elements than assault. The critical element here is, what is the act that aided or assisted the alleged assault? The act in this case, from the original petition and from the second petition, is the alleged appointment of her brother. Because that's the idea. This political appointment somehow gave him access and enabled him to, in this case, give an unwanted kissing that creates the assault claim. And so it is that political act that is protected. There is no allegation of bodily injury from that. And so I don't think that by throwing out bodily injury on an aiding and abetting, you suddenly get the protections of that exemption. And that's the case, the Caven case that they cite. The Caven versus Abbott out of Austin. And in that case, Caven was the defendant and the movement, like Aaron Pena would be in this circumstance. And the court said, no, there's actually very detailed allegations in that case, different than this case. But the distinguishing factor in that case, it was the person in the shoes of at least Aaron Pena, the person being accused of the assault, not aiding and abetting. We have to look to the pleading. We have to look to the pleading.
Want to make sure I'm understanding your argument correctly. So you're telling this court that the cause of action of aiding and abetting assault is not a bodily injury claim. Is that what you're telling me? You're telling us?
It doesn't have to be.
Okay.
For purposes of the statute, not at all. In fact, even as originally pled as against Aaron Pena, it didn't fall under the statute. That's why they realized there was a fatal defect, and they went, despite the court only saying change your affidavit, that's why they amended their pleading. They knew, as alleged, even against Aaron Pena in the original petition, that there was a problem and a fatal defect. And that's why they amended when we reconvened. And that's why we objected to that. And we said that the court shouldn't allow that. The statute provides deadlines for responses. It doesn't allow you to replead. But that's okay,
but it doesn't disallow you to replead. So let's talk about the fatal, what you consider the amended pleading, and this court should not take it into consideration. Where in the rules do you find it that the plaintiff can no longer plead? I know that it says it has to stay all discovery. I know what the trial court said in that hearing. But where in the rules does it say you can't amend a pleading?
I don't think it says you can or can't.
Okay.
It said, but in this case, there was a deadline for a response. And in this case, there was a hearing scheduled. Everyone showed up. And at that hearing, with the deadlines passed, there was not a single shred
Was that a scheduling order or what? What?
It was an order from the court setting a hearing on the motion.
Was it a scheduling order or was it just a...
I don't believe so.
Was it a first hearing that after a motion is filed?
I believe it was a setting on this motion only. There hadn't been a scheduling order for the case yet because these would have been dispositive motions.
And when the when the matter was rescheduled, did you object to the resetting?
We didn't object to them doing what they said they were going to do, which was to go get an affidavit.
Okay.
And that's why it's quoted. We did object.
So you didn't object to the resetting?
Not to the resetting.
Okay. Thank you.
We objected to the amendment of the pleadings and amending the response.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when I get a case, I've been in the district court for many years, and if it's an assault case like this one, I mean, the regular rules apply to any assault case, you know, injury case that is filed. And when you file your motion, like immunity or for jurisdiction or the general rules apply to the litigation until, you know, there's a prima facie case made. So the judge has ultimate high discretion in matters of settings and the like.
Oh, yes. Yes, Your Honor. We didn't object to resetting because counsel asked for the opportunity to give an affidavit.
Sure.
At that time of his client, we didn't object to that. We said, okay, let's come back. What we objected to is when he came back and did more than that. He didn't bring an affidavit of his client. He brought some affidavit of a third party, not a party to this case, trying to verify the allegations in this petition, calling it her petition, but it was a third party. And we'll get to that. But that gets to the second frame. So I think either if you...
Justice Longoria had a question. Go ahead.
My question was, so you objected to the amendment of the pleadings and the court did not strike him. Don't you think he implicitly agreed to have the amended petition before the court?
I think by not granting our objection, he considered it.
Yes.
And that's why we preserve that as one of our basis on appeal.
And is that an abuse of discretion review for this court, I'm assuming?
I think it is on the pleading part.
On the pleading.
I think it did affect the outcome. If you find that the bodily injury was not pled the first time, which it wasn't, but it was pled the second time, and therefore that's the reason, it affects the whole.
But then if I find it in the first one, or we find it, I know I say but I always mean we. Then the amended petition is irrelevant.
Correct.
If we find that the bodily injury was properly in the first petition, I'll get this right.
In the original petition,
right.
And I think if you looked at the cases that we cited, there's one case directly on point to show why the allegations as alleged in the original petition don't get them there. That's why they amended. They realized there was a fatal defect in the first. And it wasn't that they amended with evidence. I'm going to say that again. It wasn't that they amended with evidence, they just threw the label out there, ruling out it was defective. And that takes us to step two. What evidence did they show to establish a prima facie case? When given an opportunity, the district judge gave them an opportunity to give an affidavit. Instead of taking an affidavit from their client, the plaintiff, they show up with this affidavit of a third person, Brandy Pettis. And Ms. Pettis purports to verify the veracity of all the allegations in the original petition. So we filed several objections because it is impossible for her to have personal knowledge or a foundation for any of that. Let me give a prime example, and this is critical. The alleged assault, the unwanted kissing, according to the plaintiff, Aaron Pena gives the plaintiff a ride home. There are two people in the car, the plaintiff and Aaron Pena. And according to the allegations, he has an unwanted kissing. She says stop. Then he takes her home. Okay, there's only two people that could have firsthand knowledge of that, Aaron Pena and the plaintiff. The plaintiff chooses not to verify her pleadings, not to give an affidavit whatsoever. So Brandy Pettis comes in and signs an affidavit that says this is my petition and I verify it. Kind of a weird deal, really. But if you think about it, by definition, she could not have firsthand knowledge of what happened in that car. Therefore, there was no evidence, competent evidence, as Justice Longoria said in the CDM, competent evidence for step two of the TCPA that an assault even happened, period. So when you get to bodily injury, they still have a burden to show the prima facie steps. And there just wasn't evidence. And it was critical and reversible error not to rule on the objections to that affidavit. There are many more. That's a central point of that affidavit. The other allegations they rely upon, I see my time is running down. The other allegations they relied upon were that Ms. Perez somehow speculated about what Ms. Pena Garza knew from a conversation she had after the fact of the alleged assault.
You're out of time, but I thought that the affidavit only hit the points, if any, as we look at it, as to whether when you talk about aid and abetted and what's required under Texas law is whether Mrs. Pena knew or had knowledge regarding the action that may occur. So it was kind of, I thought, addressed more, not whether the tort actually occurred, just so you know, but as to whether Ms. Pena had knowledge.
What's interesting?
Of what was going to occur.
But the problem with that is, let's just say that that was an after-the-fact statement. Let's say that that's some evidence of knowledge. You still have, number one element, that an underlying tort occurred. There's no evidence whatsoever of that. Number two, that
Well, aren't we supposed to take the pleadings of the plaintiff as evidence, whether they're verified or not, under the statute?
Actually, you're supposed to look at affidavits on both sides.
Right.
And you're supposed to weigh it. And whether it's, I think Justice Longoria said it well in that CDM case. I think it's basically bare, baseless opinions do not create fact issues, and neither are they substitutes for clear and convincing evidence required to establish a prima facie case. Conclusory statements are insufficient from CDM. You don't have that here. And I'll reserve my rest for rebuttal. Thanks. If I have any left.
You will. We will give you your full 5 minutes.
May it please the court again, Carlos Escobar for the appellee. I just want to start out by making this one statement to make sure that this court is very clear that all of the parties involved in this particular case are Republican. Cadence Vaughn is a member of the Republican Party. So I know, you know, Mr. Davis may have looked at this as some kind of political hit job, but there's no Democrat versus Republican animosity in this case. This is a civil war, so to speak, because this all occurred within the Republican Party. And so the fact that, you know, the different insinuations that are being made, I don't think really hold true because this is all in the same party. But I want to start at where I guess Your Honor Benavides began. I mean, I think this is an easy case. I think that this is very simple, very direct, extremely clear that the allegations made by Appellee Vaughn fall under the bodily injury exception under 27.010A3 of the TCPA. I cite another case there. It's the Temple versus Cortez, 657 Southwest 337, Dallas 2023. It's a recent case, and in that case, it's very clear. It says the TCPA does not apply to any legal action for bodily injury. In this particular case, I know there's some dispute as to whether or not the original petition should be the one that this court reviews or the amended petition. My point on this is that I don't know how you get around Rule 65, which is how you amend your pleadings. Once an amended petition is filed, it supplants and supersedes entirely the original petition.
That's why I was asking Mr. Davis, is there anything different? And I had the rule book in front of me because I thought, is there anything different that disallows a plaintiff at any time to amend their pleading while the motion is pending?
The answer is no, Your Honor. And it's no for a number of reasons. I mean, we'll just take, for example, a plea to the jurisdiction. A plea to the jurisdiction is a dispositive motion. It can completely gut somebody's case. You can file an amended petition the morning before the hearing. There's no deadline for that. right? In a motion for summary judgment, the TCPA specifically states that the motion for summary judgment protocols and procedures are the ones that the TCPA is akin to. And so even under a motion for summary judgment procedure, in the particular case, in this particular case, the amended petition was filed 13 days before the hearing. And under summary judgment rules, you'd have to file an amended petition 7 days prior to the hearing. So we're almost double the time for notice, for objections, for whatever it is Mr. Davis wanted to do. In fact, he may have been able to say, Judge, you know what? I want to hear my motion to strike before we get to this hearing, because he had 2 weeks to do it, and say, here, I want you to rule, Judge, that you can't consider the First Amendment. But he didn't do that. So I think you have waiver all over the place. And we don't even have to get into that. But Rule 65, I don't know how you get around that. This court, as a matter of law, cannot consider the original petition, because Rule 65 says what it says. It completely supplants and supersedes the original petition. All the case law says that once you file an amended petition, the earlier ones are nullities under the law.
And so let's talk about whether the original petition, as a follow-up to that, let's not look at the amended petition just for now, for the sake of argument this morning. Does the original petition suffice the bodily injury exception under Section 27.01?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
How does it does if you're not making any claim for bodily injury damages?
Well, Your Honor, it's twofold. And I guess what I'll do is I'll talk to you about this, the line of cases that talk about mental injury versus physical injury. And under under personal injury, personal injury jurisprudence, I believe the case I'm thinking about, it's the SCI line of cases for DTPA mental anguish when there's no physical injury. And I believe there has to be, I believe it's physical manifestation of the, you have to have physical manifestation of mental anguish in order for it to be actionable when there's no actual physical contact.
Correct.
Okay. And so it may be inarticulate, but there's nothing here that prohibits that type of injury. A physical manifestation of mental injury can be encompassed in the pleading that was provided to the court when she said bodily injury. Again, this is the original petition. There's no discovery that's been done yet. We don't know. And so what I'm saying to Your Honor is,
as I'm looking at what aiding and abetting cause of action would only be a type of mental anguish. There would be never no bodily injury.
Well,
I mean, there would be no physical injury. That's, I guess, the better word, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree with that because, okay. This is a derivative liability claim. So whatever Aaron Pena's assault results in physical injury, but under the law, because you are complicit in it via aiding and abetting, then the injury is as if, under the law, Ms. Pena Garza was the one who did the same act as Mr. Aaron.
And one of the elements of a derivative cause of action of aiding and abetting is there has to be an assault, I guess, by a third party.
That's correct. You have to prove that's correct, Your Honor. The very first, I'm citing Jewell versus Arrington, 936 Southwest 2nd, 640. The first element of an aiding and abetting claim is that you have to allege or have proof of that the primary actor, in this case Aaron Pena, committed a tort, and that tort was assault. And so that's the first element. And I mean, I don't know if we're going to get into the waiver argument, but that is something that you have to establish so that you can have the rest of the elements follow, which is, did the person that committed the assault, were they assisted, were they aided, were they encouraged, were they provided with things to help them commit this tort? In our case, the answer is yes. We pled it that way. That's what all the allegations in the amended petition and even in the original petition assert, that Pena Garza made affirmative acts, took affirmative steps to encourage and aid Mr. Pena in his assault. And chiefly what it is, and I believe it's clerk's record 85 and then 87 through 89, where aside and apart from this appointment, there are allegations that aside from the appointment itself to this vacancy committee, Adrian Peña Garza promoted Aaron Peña within the party, aside and apart from this appointment, to put him in close situations with young females. And we spent some time in the petition talking about it. The instances of prior conduct.
So let me ask you this question, Mr. Escobar. Do we need to have that? Is the allegations in the petition sufficient to suffice your burden that you are exempted under this portion of the statute, or does it need to be verified?
No, Your Honor, it does not have to be need to be verified, because the TCPA explicitly allows this court, and it's in the statute itself. I mean, the case law says that pleadings are the best and all sufficient evidence of the nature of the claim. That's Hearst versus Tatum, 526 Southwest 3rd, 462. The pleadings are, in a TCPA motion to dismiss, the pleadings can suffice to meet the burden that opposing a motion to dismiss.
Would you agree that you have the burden of proof to show that you fit under the exception?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe we do. We alleged bodily injury, and we were able to. Right. I cited Martinez versus Pluma. That's 2020 Westlaw 7391699. It states that evidence of physical pain will satisfy the statutory requirement of bodily injury to support a civil assault claim. In the First Amendment petition, we allege physical pain, and specifically, if you look at the facts, you know, Aaron Peña placed his hands on her legs, you know. She recoiled from that. She told him to stop. Afterwards, he grabs her forcibly by the neck and forces a kiss with her. That's the assault. And within that, she experienced physical pain. It's alleged in the petition. I don't know how they get around that. I don't think there's no way they can do it. The case that I just gave you says that. As long as we allege physical pain, which is alleged, it suffices for bodily injury to support a civil assault claim. That's why I think this is an easy case. You're done there.
Let me ask you this. Assume with me that the judge and the district court and us later, the judge finds that the defense has made a prima facie case, that this is a political case, that, you know, there was politics involved in the litigation somehow. But assume that we find that there was a prima facie case. Assume further that the burden shifts now to the plaintiff, and the plaintiff satisfies, makes a prima facie case that this is a bodily injury, a case. Which side trumps? Is it the TCPA that trumps, that requires a dismissal, or is it the plaintiff's bodily injury claim that trumps the TCPA position?
I'm biased, Your Honor, but I would definitely say that there's another argument that I make here. I don't even think the TCPA applies to this because it's criminal conduct. And if you're alleging and suing for criminal conduct, the TCPA cannot be involved. And I cite the O'Brien case. It's a Supreme Court case.
But we're in the prima facie stage to determine whether or not to dismiss or not, or whether apply the exemption.
Well, I would say that under this case, yes, if the burden is on the plaintiff to show that the exemption applies,
right.
But the burden was on the defendant to show that the TCPA applied initially. And what I'm saying is that if you're suing for criminal conduct.
And this is where I'm coming from. Before you answer, what your answer is that,
yes, Your Honor.
I've been involved in a lot of litigation where there has been sexual abuse against priests or people of the cloth, and they try to raise, you know, hey, this is a religious issue versus a sexual issue, as kind of sort of here, and we've allowed them to proceed with the litigation, saying that, you know, the criminal act applies rather than the religious freedom to associate.
Right.
And it's kind of similar here because one is this politics gives us the cover against these type of litigations.
Right. Well, but crime can occur anywhere. It can occur in the context of religious organizations at HEB or Walmart or the Republican Party.
And one of the exemptions in this statute, the TCPA statute, is that family law, you know, like we have husbands and wives, we have a lot of assault accusations in the area of family law or criminal cases. Those are exemptions against a TCPA, defense.
No, absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, really what I believe this comes down to, I mean, despite the burdens, but specifically right now what I'm talking about is whether or not Adrian Peña-Garza's burden, which is the following, to show by the greater weight of the evidence that Vaughn's lawsuit is based on or is in response to Adrian Peña-Garza's exercise of the right to associate. And that's their burden. What I'm saying to this court, and I think it's probably a matter of law issue, I think, because United States versus O'Brien, that's the United States Supreme Court, it says the First Amendment does not protect violent or unlawful conduct, even if the person engaging in that conduct intends to express an idea. And so here, this is what I think makes a difference in this particular case. The case law is very clear. Criminal assault and civil assault, identical elements. Identical. The law of parties, Texas Penal Code 7.02, it's aiding and abetting. They're virtually identical. And so if there is a crime committed and the law allows you to recover for the crime that was committed, and that is what's pled, then I don't see how the TCPA can apply, because it cannot stop a civil lawsuit to recover for the criminal acts and the injuries stemming therefrom. That's where we are. I mean, it shouldn't do this. I mean, it shouldn't go that far. And I was looking at it this morning and I was debating on whether to call the court's attention to it. But if you look at 27010 at the very bottom, Your Honor, on the exemptions, it says that does apply to claims against a victim. And in there it cites 22 point, I think, et sec of the penal code. Chapter 22 is the assault statute. Chapter 22 of the Penal Code is the assault statute. And in the TCPA statute, it says claims against the victim are covered by the TCPA. But it didn't make it the other way. And there's principles under statutory construction that say the specific language, if it's covering something, then implicitly the law is that it doesn't cover the opposite scenario. And so here, that's what we have, because it makes sense. The policy should be you cannot allow someone to stop a civil lawsuit based upon a criminal act. And we have two criminal acts here, the assault and then the aiding and abetting, both of which are recognized by the Texas Penal Code that you can also sue civilly for. That is I can't see how if the violence and the criminal allegations that are made in our pleading, I can't see how the TCPA would be able to prohibit us from proceeding with those claims. Because again, I mean, the underlying policy is the First Amendment does not protect violent or unlawful conduct, even if the person engaging in it intends to express an idea. Now that's speech that they're talking about. We're talking about association here. Association, well, can you associate with someone? This particular assault occurred in the context of these young women being taken to political events by Mr. Peña. And he put himself in that position so he could exploit it, and he did. And so some of the facts that I think the court should know about, I mean, this is a very small-sized person, female, in a car alone with Mr. Peña. And she, you know, there's some allegations. Well, where are the medical bills? How is this a physical injury case? This is not a real, look, what we're talking about is a slight individual, female, young, in the car by herself with an individual. And she's afraid about what he's going to do. Well, if I hit him, what am I going to get assaulted? Is it going to get worse? What's going to happen? I don't know. So a female being put in that position, and yeah, she didn't go to the hospital. She didn't break any bones. But that is a gross violation of the law. It's punishable by a crime because it's in the penal code.
In the petition that she sued Ms. Peña Garza, individually and as a representative of the Republican Party, or is it just strictly an individual petition?
Just individual allegation. There are no allegations of capacity other than individual capacities in this lawsuit.
Okay.
That's what it is. But I mean, I'd like to continue on it. It looks like I have a minute, but I just want to briefly address the waiver argument. And I think it all comes back to the same thing in my opinion, because the very, very first element of an aiding and abetting claim is that you have to have an underlying tort committed by another person. The TCPA motion to dismiss only asked to dismiss the claim against Adrian Peña Garza. It did not ask to dismiss the underlying assault claim. Well, how can, I mean, in my opinion, Your Honor, it's a fatal mistake, because all the case law says you can't separate an aiding and abetting claim from the underlying tort, which is the assault in this case. You can't do it. And so if he never attacked that claim and asked the court to dismiss that claim, how can he ask this court to consider it? Judge Ramirez, in the 332nd, never got a motion in front of him that says a motion requesting that the court dismiss the assault claim. He never got that. And here it's critical, because that element of the assault is the first element of the aiding and abetting claim. So if the trial court wasn't able to consider whether or not the assault claim should be thrown out, how are you going to throw out the aiding and abetting claim? You can't do it. The case law says they're tied together. You can't separate them. And just be, it's 33.1. It's waiver. You didn't ask the court to dismiss the assault, because otherwise you can't separate them. I see that my time's up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Just a few things. There would have been no amendment had the original petition satisfied the bodily injury. Period, end of story. The original petition claimed mental pain and anguish. That's precisely why they did that. And there was a question about, well, is there anything that prevents the amendment? We've addressed that in our brief on page 35 and 36. So Rule 91, for example, has a provision that allows and encourages amendment before a motion to dismiss gets granted. It says, hey, they've called you out on that, amend. There is no such provision in the TCPA. So we've argued that they shouldn't have been allowed, besides the grant of leave was only for an affidavit, they shouldn't have been allowed to amend, and it shouldn't be considered.
One of the things that I pulled out, Mr. Davis, because you're talking about that, was the order resetting the hearing that was signed by Judge Ramirez. And the court finds that the motion was previously set for a hearing on January 24th. However, pursuant to Texas Civil Practicing Remedies Code Section 27.004, taking judicial notice of the court's docket conditions, the court finds good cause to reset the hearing, and it's still within the 90 days of service of the motion. And nowhere in here, nor do I see it anywhere in the hearing that I read, that he limits any of that discovery. I mean, I know that the affidavit is discussed.
Yes.
Aside from that, I didn't see anything that the trial court said you can't amend your pleading. Did I miss something?
No.
And there wasn't anything in the order that the judge signed.
No, only that the discussion was, Judge, I need time for an affidavit. Can right. I do it? And the judge says, sure. So I asked for clarification. It's on page 35. And I say, okay, just to clarify, Judge, he's asked for an opportunity to present an affidavit in support. I understand the court's ruling. You're going to give him time within the deadlines to do that? Yes. So there wasn't a discussion of, Judge, when we come back, I'm going to have a new pleading and a new response and a new theory. But I guess
the record go on to say, didn't you ask further on the record? And that means no amendment of pleadings and stuff like that. The court did not respond.
No, there was no order preventing it. Right. And there was no order like allowing it. And he said, you can raise your objections. There was no ruling on it. I mean, I think obviously we can assume that our motion to strike the amended pleading was overruled, you know, and that he considered it.
Right.
You know, I think that's the reality of it.
Okay.
But I guess the point is most of the argument you just heard would be very persuasive if I'm standing up here for Aaron Pena now. Because it's a direct assault claim. They're going to have their day in court, okay? They're going to have their day in court, and Mr. Pena believes that that'll be shown to be frivolous, whatever. That's why he's not a movement in a TCPA. So this waiver argument about, wait a minute, Ms. Pena Garza, you should have attacked the assault claim. The assault claim was not made against her. She's going to file a motion to dismiss an assault claim that's not made against her? Now, as part of the claim to dismiss the aiding and abetting, she did show that they cannot make their prima facie case of even the assault. The only way they did that was a verification of someone that was not in the car. So it's borderline just frivolous. There is no evidence. I agree with the counsel when he said, what do we look at the pleadings for? We look at the pleadings for step one of the TCPA. Does it apply? The Hirsch case that he talks about, Lipsky says, let's look at the pleadings and see if, as alleged, that's the best source, does the TCPA apply? And that's why we say, when you look at the pleadings, it's a political appointment. It's a decision. That's the basis for the claims against Adrian Pena, who's here before you today. So it does apply. You don't get to satisfy your burden of the prima facie case with just the pleadings. It's more akin to the motion for summary judgment, as Justice Longoria talked about in CDM. Finally, I'll just say that the whole predicate for what you just heard, the notion of why Aaron Pena was in a car, was because her sister Adrian appointed him to a position. That has been conclusively and demonstrably shown to be false. She made no such appointment. No such appointment. And they're not contesting that. They didn't know that when they filed the suit, but they know it now, and it was before the court. So the only allegation of aiding and abetting stems from this appointment that never happened. There is no basis for it. So we don't have to guess about whether they reached the prima facie case or anything else. It's been conclusively disproven under step three. I see that I'm out of time, and I would ask you to respectfully reverse the court's decision and dismiss the claims against Ms. Pena Garza.
The case will be under submission.